Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to Strange Familiars. If you have had an experience with the paranormal and you'd like to share your story, you can email strangefamiliarspodcast@gmail.com. Allison, you're wearing the proper socks for this evening?
I am wearing stolen Bigfoot socks.
Yes, they were my Bigfoot socks. And now they are no longer my Bigfoot socks.
They were clean socks.
that's pretty much all it is. So tonight is probably one of the final Where the Footprints End interviews that Josh and I did together, hosted by one Allison, sitting right next to me. I'm sure we'll do a couple more here and there, but as far as interviews we had scheduled, like interviews on the calendar, I think this is the last one. So hopefully we'll end up doing Coast to Coast AM. We might end up doing another podcast here and there together, but this kind of really heralds the end of a long journey.
Is this Where the Footprints End?
It may be. Years that Josh and I put into this together. We've been tied at the hip.
That is a three-legged race I would watch.
So, as is the case with the last time that we talked about Volume 1 of Where the Footprints End, we went off the reservation and we talk about related stuff and weird stuff and at least some of the conversation, I think, was stuff that we don't get to talk about on other podcasts. I think we kind of went in a little bit different direction. So,
yeah, I mean, unfortunately, I didn't really approach it so much as like a promo interview based on your book, so much as like, hey, let's just talk about the current state of Bigfoot.
Yeah, no, I think that's fine. And I think it's kind of appropriate. And like Josh said, it's kind of a nice capstone to the whole experience. Before we get to that, I want to thank our wonderful sponsors, 90 Days to the Perfect Puppy. If you have a puppy and you need help with your puppy, 90 Days to the Perfect Puppy can help you. They have a relationship-based approach to training. They help you and your puppy become perfect for each other. It's not about making that puppy perfect. It's about the two of you kind of learning to work together. You learn the puppy learns you, and you become perfect for each other as the program goes on.
It kind of mirrors adult interaction, hopefully.
Let's hope.
Although I do desperately want to change you.
It can't be done.
No, it can't. I know that.
90 Days to the Perfect Puppy has online services like video lessons. They have a super secret Facebook group. Mm. It may just be regular secret, but I'm calling it super secret, where you can join other people with puppies who may be having issues that you're having or issues you might run into, and you can see how they solve their problems. And of course, they have one-on-one options as well. You can find 90 Days to the Perfect Puppy at sithappens.us. Look for the 90 Days to the Perfect Puppy link at the top of the page. Let 90 Days to the Perfect Puppy help you understand how your dog thinks and apply proactive training methods so you and your puppy
can be perfect for each other.
Exactly. Again, that's sithappens.us. Look for the 90 Days to the Perfect Puppy link at the top of the page. And I want to thank Sit Happens and 90 Days to the Perfect Puppy for being our sponsors. So it's a long interview or a conversation, as the case may be, with Josh and I and you.
I think you're framing that the wrong way. I'd like to say it's immersive.
It's an immersive Bigfoot experience.
Yes. I don't often get to chat about Bigfoot with anyone, which people may find hard to believe.
I know. I try not to pester you constantly.
About Bigfoot, yeah.
Yeah. I try to sort of keep it to myself a little bit. So let's go ahead and get to this conversation. Again, it's a pretty long one. Hopefully everybody will find it interesting. Welcome, Strange Familiars listeners. Got a very special episode tonight. Where the Footprints End, Volume 2. It's the book that Joshua Cutchin and I wrote together. The second volume of Where the Footprints End. It's High Strangeness and the Bigfoot Phenomenon, Volume 2, Evidence. And just like we did for the first volume, we're going to have Allison interview us, and I expect it to be the most difficult interview we do anywhere. So I'd like to welcome Josh and Allison. How you guys doing?
I am doing great. It's great to be here for the second and final installment of Where the Footprints End. The end of a very long journey. This kind of feels like the capstone on the whole thing. So
would doing you the strange say familiar. This is maybe metaphorically where the footsteps end?
Yes, they end at Allison.
They were now leading somewhere.
That delicate walk back.
The tiptoeing.
So this is, again, like I said, it's the second book in the series. You can start with either one. That's the way we wrote them. You can kind of start with any chapter anywhere and bounce around. But we would like you to get both volumes. You pick up volume one either from us directly or from Josh directly or from Amazon, or you can order it in at your local bookstore. You actually can get both volumes that way. Volume one and volume two, Where the Footprints End, by Joshua Cutchin and me, Timothy Renner. So Allison, hit us. Where are we going with this crazy interview?
Well, I'll have you know that all of the questions have been sealed in a mayonnaise jar on the porch of Funkin' Wagnalls since noon today. No one knows the contents.
Was there mayonnaise with them in the jar, or is this an empty mayonnaise?
No. And maybe nobody else remembers the dated Karnak Johnny Carson reference.
Yes.
Okay, so I have a real softball question, and this is one that I thought both of you could answer, and then maybe I'll take a stab at it as well. And they'll just get us started with the interview. And that is, and we'll start with Josh since he's our guest. Do you believe in Bigfoot? And if so, in what capacity?
I don't know if that's a softball question. That might be the hardest question that I've been asked. You know, it's funny when people ask me what I write about, you know, on an airplane or you know, out in public or something. It's always like, well, I want to say, you know, Bigfoot and UFOs and stuff like that, but it's never, you know, what you think I think is not what I think. So I'm like, yeah, so if I say, yes, I believe in Bigfoot, that has so much baggage. You know, it's kind of funny. We were doing a Q&A at the end of the Bigfoot Collectors Club interview, Timothy and I were, and the game was like, you know, believe it or BS. It was, you know, they went through all these paranormal things, and you know, I kind of wanted to be just like, yeah, believe it all, but with caveats in terms of like, there's this assumption that what you see is what you get, and I think with Bigfoot, what we see is not what we get, but in terms of there being a phenomena, and people seeing exactly what they're describing, yeah, I believe in Bigfoot. That's my roundabout weasel language way of getting there.
Yes, with all the qualifiers, everything we answer is going to sound like we're weaseling out of stuff, but short answer, yes, I believe in Bigfoot. Longer answer, I don't believe it's a giant monkey in the woods of North America, or at least not simply a giant monkey. I think it can take the form of a giant monkey, but it's not something we can put in a cage.
All right. Would you like me to answer the question as well? I mean, I know it's kind of tacky for the interviewer to be like, oh,
no,
yeah,
I was thinking about this earlier. I'm like, I want to, you know, hold Allison's feet to the fire and see how she actually feels about Bigfoot. Because, you know, whenever you pop up on the show, you kind of flirt with these topics, but I never hear you commit. So what do you believe in Bigfoot? Because Bigfoot believes in you.
Bigfoot pays a portion of your bills, so be kind.
Be very careful which Bigfoot you piss off. I would say that I do not believe in Well, now I feel like I'm weaseling out of it and trying to have it both ways, but
I mean, Tim and I just wrote two books of like 300 plus pages having it both ways. So I think you're entitled to that.
And I think what we're all trying to dance around is like, I don't believe in your conception of Bigfoot. Exactly. I believe in my conception of Bigfoot, which is probably the same way that people answer these like sort of heady religious questions. Like when you say, do you believe in God? Like, yeah, that's a question that some people will just answer with a very pat, simple yes, and think that everyone else thinks of it in the same capacity.
Right.
But it might not necessarily be the same capacity, or it might not be the same God, or it might not be the same mm-hmm. version of God. Am I equating Bigfoot to God? No.
No, I get what you're saying, though, because when the currency is big hairy monster, right, and that's all the deeper it goes, you know, that's a hard pill to swallow, and there's so many caveats, and it's just,
I believe that people see something akin to what we know as sort of this cliche Bigfoot? Yes. Do I believe that they've had experiences wherein they saw Bigfoot? Yes. Have I ever seen Bigfoot? No. Do I think that there's a Bigfoot in the woods? Probably not. I mean, if there is, I don't think that we've gotten to the point where we can explain it with any sort of reality.
Well, what it does is it sort of puts you into this position of contrarianism, right? Because I hear people who are skeptical and they have these really reductionist, often silly explanations to just sort of hand wave away what people see. And I leap to the defense of the people who have seen a giant monkey, you know? Mm-hmm. And then I hear people say that there's a giant monkey roaming through the woods that somehow is evading detection and, you know, selectively picking and choosing which garden to eat from and is, you know, basically a forest ninja. And then I end up taking the side of the skeptics. So, you know, it's sort of, I think that, I don't know if that's a balanced way of looking at it or what, but I think that's sort of what naturally happens if you're being, you know, kind of intellectually honest about the fact that we are dealing with earnest people saying fantastic things. You have to try to find some way to reconcile those two disparate issues.
Yeah, and I don't think I ever want to be the person that says your reality isn't true or you didn't see this, or just because my experience doesn't mirror someone else's, I don't want to discount it. Or like, I mean, and it's just so simple to just say you're crazy, and I just don't want to go in that direction because.
Well, I mean, yeah, and there's sort of an overlay, and I'm not trying to get heavy this early into the podcast, yeah, but there is an overlay that this is still the one area of trauma, the paranormal, where you can completely victim shame. And you can completely victim blame and get away with it. And if these people are, you know, if these things do exist, that's horrible. And if they don't exist and people are having mental illness issues or people were legitimately traumatized by something that for whatever reason they blew out of proportion, mm-hmm. people can still have PTSD from misidentification or something, you know? So it really is frustrating that on the one hand you'll hear that we shouldn't, you know, blame or shame victims, and those same people will turn around and laugh at, you know, alien abductees and Bigfoot witnesses, et cetera.
Absolutely.
That's a fantastic point, Josh. Like, seriously, I didn't even think about the sort of the paranormal witness being the last traumatized person that we're sort of allowed to make fun of.
And I think it comes from that real hard line, you know, plenty of people who are friends of mine who identify as atheists. but there's that sort of like that new scientism, new atheism of the 90s that came through and just made, you know, and really, I think, further stigmatized the paranormal. I think it's partially at least an outgrowth of that. But it really is sad that, I mean, because you've talked to people, Tim, that you do think have mental issues who, you know, saw something or dealing with something that seems paranormal, but probably isn't. Mm-hmm. But those people still deserve our sympathy, you know? So
of course,
it's something I always find really frustrating.
And yeah. And there's also the combination of that you could be mentally ill and still have something like this happen to you. It doesn't discount it, you know, like.
Yeah. I mean, or if you wanted to go in that direction further, like we are mistaking mental illness. I mean, there are people who have conquered schizophrenia by engaging with and having a dialogue with the voices in their head. So, you know, that sort of calls into question, maybe we're not exactly understanding what's going on there.
Well, I think we're probably just as lacking in our ability to understand mental illness as we are Bigfoot.
Probably. Yeah.
Well, that brings up an interesting point that was made a while ago that I thought was really fascinating, is that if you look at 3/4 of the conditions in the DSM, they're all anecdotal, right? Like if there's a recurring mental condition where somebody believes that they're a squirrel, like you can reveal, you know, you can take brain scans and say, oh, these people are all having the same activity in this part of their brain, et cetera. But like at the end of the day, you're building your entire diagnosis of this mental syndrome or whatever around the fact that the person believes that they're a squirrel, and so does this person over here. So it really is that sort of perception meets reality barrier that we run into a lot.
Because we sort of dove into the slightly heavier, I thought it might be a funny thing to throw out what I thought was a softball question, but really is like the question of the entire Bigfoot community.
Well,
when you say you believe in Bigfoot, I was thinking about this earlier today. Bigfoot and a few other spaces, let's say, I deal with this because sometimes I deal with people within the photo community who are really involved in the Civil War. And so there are people who have in their sort of, I would say, regular life, two entirely disparate ways of seeing things who come together because of this one thing that they're very passionate about, be it Civil War, the history, or Bigfoot and the paranormal. And it's this, I think it has the potential to be a place for growth and understanding, because that's something that we've been, maybe it's the COVID, I don't know, but our humanity has left the building for a while. And we just see everyone as the other. Mm-hmm. And not in the way that you guys usually talk about the other. We just see it as the good guys and the bad guys.
Right.
And I think it's one place where we have the potential to really find some common ground. But what I'm doing is, like, I know right now I'm saying, well, I don't believe in the Bigfoot that the crazy people believe in, you know, like.
Right, right.
And so I'm already like choosing sort of almost a political side to it, which is not something I think there was a time when maybe we could discuss this where it wouldn't be part of another identity. And if we can remove that, maybe there could be some potential understanding. Because as a skeptic, I think, like Tim always talked about that, who is it, the OTO, or who was it that would appoint someone as like sort of the jester who would...
The IOT, Lumos the Thanateros, yeah.
That they would appoint someone who would question everything, mm-hmm. even if it was the narrative of the group.
Right.
I think that's an important concept that we've forgotten, that sort of check yourself while you're busy checking everyone else. Check yourself, you know, allow that you might be wrong, allow that your position might change. My position on Bigfoot has definitely changed. Yeah. And it's because I've seen people who have experienced it, and I don't want to discount their experiences. It's a weird place to be in when you can't trust your senses and trust what you see, or trust what you hear, or trust what you think you see. So that's all you have to go on. I mean, all I know is that people experience things, and they don't always experience the same things I do. And if that means I believe in Bigfoot, then I guess I believe in Bigfoot.
That's the reason I try to be conscious of. So when I'm talking about this, and I'm talking about these kind of weirder concepts of, you know, this thing being here and not being here at the same time, and you know, archetypes and apparitions and this and that, I always try to make the point that if someone is just driving down the road and they see a Bigfoot cross the street, or a hunter's in a tree stand and they see one walking by, I completely understand how those people are going to think it's just a monster. It's just a hairy ape, whatever they think, you know. It's just a normal thing that you could capture in a cage. I get that, and I always try to be sympathetic to that. But if you dig into it in an honest way, I truly believe you come across so much weirdness, you know, 600 plus pages of weirdness in the case of our books, that at some point you just shake your head and you go, okay, this is too weird. This is too weird to be just an ape in the woods.
Well, I mean, I would draw a straight line from that description to, you know, people who see some sort of unidentified craft in the sky. Those are usually the people who are going to go straight for, you know, the extraterrestrial hypothesis. Mm-hmm. Whereas the experiencers and abductees that I talk to are much more comfortable saying, even the ones who sort of veer towards the extraterrestrial hypothesis, they aren't going down that little green men scientist route, like, visiting scientists from another planet. They don't go down that route. Even if they go down the ET route, they're talking about consciousness, they're talking about near-death experiences, they're talking about the shamanic awakening. They're talking about things that are a little bit more complex. And I would sort of draw a line between, the person who sees a UFO in the sky to the person who has, a roadside crossing, or who's a hunter who happens to see a Bigfoot. And then I would draw a line from the experiencers of, the alien abduction experience, alien contact experience, whatever you want to call it, and people who are repeat witnesses of Bigfoot or habituators. Those are the people who generally have the stranger things happening to them. And I think that that might say something about the way that the phenomena picks and chooses witnesses, maybe.
I think that Bigfoot maybe is just a mirror, like most phenomenon, because it's in the way in which we experience it.
Yeah, well, just thinking about this in general, and so this is speculation. I don't know anything. I don't know anything. No one does. Like, no one, as Wes Germer says, like, no one has one in their garage that they're experimenting on that they can tell you what this thing really is. So
I actually do, and it's going to be revealed next Wednesday. It's going to be live on YouTube, and so...
Pay now. make sure to sign up now. In any case, boy, I forget where I was going with that.
Oh, I'm sorry, Tim.
I can podcast spackle for you while you try to recall your missing memories here. Because I totally agree with what Allison said. I mean, I sort of, this came to me when I was talking to Greg on Radio Misterioso, is how, like, there are fewer images that could be more laden with symbolism than the wild man, I think.
I mean, yes. And now I remember where I was going. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And when I talk about, like, the collective unconscious or about this, appearing as a symbol to people, and again, it's pure speculation. I don't, like I said, I don't know anything. But I feel like if it's something that's drawing from us, it's also drawing from the collective unconscious. So what you get is this collective idea of the wild man that comes up. And I think that's why, and we've talked about it before, the wild man changes over time. He's gotten more savage, apparently, over time.
I mean, you look at Bigfoot, you look at the wild man, and it makes you question the line between, man and animal. It makes you question how civilized we actually are. It makes you question, what separates you from your animalistic base instincts. There's so much symbolism there. I mean, it's part of the reason that you have that trope of, the wild man abducting women, which happens time and time again. I'm looking at a statue of King Kong I have here in my office. So,
wait, you didn't get your wife with the club and take her by the hair? That's not...
No, it was the other way around, actually.
Oh, okay.
She grabbed me by the beard. I get that there's, like, fetal symbolism in the alien gray, and there's a lot of emotional baggage there, but just from, like, if you asked a psychiatrist to come up with an image that asks us to question our own humanity, I think that the hair covered wild man would be, like, one of the most potent things you could come up with that people would immediately identify with right away.
Yeah, and the futuristic humanoid with the big brain, right, on the other side.
Yeah, I've thought about that. Like, are we just seeing, man, are we seeing our what we have descended from and what we'll ascend to? Like, are we just, between looking at the...
I think perhaps we've gone back to basics, because with the internet, we've kind of killed the collective unconscious, right? Because everything you do doesn't spring from sort of a wellspring of your own creativity. Now it's, like, fact-checked against other people who might be doing the same thing, and, like, you don't have these amazing scientific discoveries that spring up at the same exact time in history without any knowledge of the other person working on it. Everything's so known now that we really have killed that collective unconscious, and... maybe because we've killed it, we have to go back to the very basics, and that is the past and the future, how we see those represented as our primitive and more advanced forms. And then we can start from there and build again. I guess now I'm every person in the comments of the other thing that said that I'm off on some trip somewhere.
Yeah.
Would you like to move on from this to another question, perhaps?
Well, I feel like we started off real heavy. So
I wanted to, and maybe this will just sort of circle back to where we were, but one of the things in naming the second book Evidence is like how conscious were both of you of this idea of that, that's such a weighted word in today's world and that evidence must be entirely scientific, and is there such a thing as like a scientific version of folklore?
Interesting. It's very, very interesting. So the way we separated the books,
you pull a King Solomon and just split it.
Yeah, it was basically fortune, because I think because of my love and interest in folklore, I had finished the chapters that lean more heavily on folklore first, and we were talking about just getting one volume out. And we looked at the chapters that were done, and we kind of, like, in an instant realized these all fit together. And the other chapters that we haven't published, they kind of fit together too. And I said, let's just call it Volume 1 Folklore. And I think almost immediately Josh said, okay, Volume 2 Evidence. So there wasn't, like, a ton of, like, back and forth thought that went into naming Volume 2 Evidence. I think it was just something that sprung up, but it happened to be very prescient. Because we do talk about missing evidence and the trackways and, vocalizations. And the
ephemera.
The sort of ephemera that's left behind in Volume 2 a lot more than Volume 1. So it wasn't really that long of a process coming up with that title. It just kind of fit that way.
Well, and they're pretty dang close to being the exact same length in both books.
Yeah.
In terms of, you know, word count, index and whatnot might, and sources might change the number of pages, but in terms of actual content, it's pretty close. You know, I do think, though, Allison, I kind of worry about some people thinking that Volume 2 Evidence is where we prove interdimensional Bigfoot or something, you know, that they're like, oh, this is where they get down to it. They're making a kid, and we don't. I mean, you know, it's these so-called experts that we are, you know, mm-hmm. talking about, telling you exactly what's going on with Bigfoot. We don't do that at all. And that's part of the reason that Tim and I jive well together, I think, is like, you know, Tim might write something in three books that completely contradicts some of the things that he argues or thinks about in this book. And I sure as heck am. You know, I made the case that Bigfoot has something in common with, you know, witches or Solomonic demons in Volume 1. And like, that's not where my head is at for the next book. It's just trying to present people with options and thought experiments, because if you just have a collection of stories on, you know, in a book, then it's Bigfoot porn, right? I mean, it's the equivalent of pornography. It's just there for reactions, and you don't learn anything. You don't get any insight. You don't walk away better enlightened, better educated. You know, it's Bigfoot porno. Not like that kind of Bigfoot porn.
Where you'd make some actual cash for it.
Yeah.
But, and as regards science and folklore, it's interesting because, you know, I hit on the cryptozoologists a lot, not in the terms of asking them to go out on dates, but in the terms of, you know, pointing out the what I consider fallacies in their thought and so-called scientific method. And in this book, I make a very, very clear point, which as yet has not been picked up on as much as I would like. So I'm glad to stress it here, that the cryptozoologist paradigm is unfit for the Bigfoot phenomenon, because we've moved beyond thinking it's some sort of great ape. And in general, the accepted theory is that this is, if you believe it's something that can be put in a cage, the belief is that it's a relict hominid. So this is some relation to human. This is a hominid. This is in our family in some way. And what we need instead dealing with this creature is cryptoanthropology. And I think folklore fits in very, very nicely with cryptoanthropology, not so much with cryptozoology.
You know, this kind of brings up something, and I'm usually the last person on the planet to throw these sort of barbs, but I will say that in going through this book and seeing, or these books, and seeing indigenous people say, you know, this creature, this blanket term Bigfoot, Bigfoot disappears, Bigfoot, you know, speaks to us, Bigfoot this and that and the other, and then looking at the way that cryptozoologists say, well, that means that Bigfoot is really good at hiding behind trees, or Bigfoot is really good, you know, Bigfoot has multiple sets of vocal cords. There is sort of a weird colonial racism, tisk tisk, you poor brown people don't know what you're talking about kind of vibe still in cryptozoology.
I think we were kind of talking about that the last time we had an interview, because like that is partly what I heard. When, for one thing, I don't understand where a lot of these ideas about, and maybe you guys can speak to that, because I just truly don't know, like, who was the first person who said that Bigfoot does blank? You know, I like, is there a, did you find that as you were working on things, like how, like these sculptures and things in the woods, like who, where is the first mention of that? And is that just something someone said?
I think there are certain pet theories that you kind of see people introduce here and there, but
they
that
become
specifically
like canon.
Yeah,
they do become canon. And yeah, it becomes this sort of known, you know, the trope of Bigfoot tiptoeing backwards to his own tracks becomes sort of a known. And I mean, in their defense, you know, when I talked about my chessboard for the first time on Where Did the Road Go, I talked about it entirely as a Bigfoot experience. And it was Soraya and Josh that kind of, you know, slapped me out of that idea and said, well, you didn't see a Bigfoot. How do you know it was Bigfoot? And like I said, in a way, that was sort of the genesis of this whole book. It was me sort of waking up and realizing I didn't see a Bigfoot. I don't know it was Bigfoot. And just going, oh, and having my sort of, my view shifted, you know, at that point. So, yeah, I mean, I do get, I guess, how, you know, if a structure appears in the middle of the woods in a place where there are Bigfoot sightings, it's, I guess, kind of logical to go, oh, Bigfoot must have built that. Now, when you
but
break
that's
that
a scientific, the thing is, that's a scientific fallacy.
It is. It is. When you start breaking it down, you realize, well, no, that's not, it doesn't work. But,
and that's the thing I've been curious about the whole time, and maybe you guys can explain this to me, but cryptozoologists who are, let's say, Bigfoot cryptozoologists, as opposed to people who have, say, a scientific degree in cryptozoology, they lean heavily on some sort of scientific physicality of this creature, but there is no science there. It's there's not employing a scientific method. It's like factual leaps based on, well, if this happens and this happens, then these two things are related. I mean, they're just, it's just fundamentally not scientific. And then to come after people who are not taking a scientific approach seems ironic at the least and hypocritical. Am I wrong there?
No, I mean, so to be clear, there are cryptozoologists who are
actual,
you know, who are actually taking a look at this in a very careful, methodical way. And just, you know, similarly, there are cryptids that I think stand a good chance of being outed as actual flesh and blood creatures. I am a big champion of the fact that there's probably still a remnant population of thylacines. I think Adam Davies, even before his Devil Ewok portal experience, which is a great harrowing story we can get into sometime, is doing great work towards the possibility of revealing Orang Pendek as being, a relic species. And then you have all these other, you know, sort of minor cryptozoological discoveries that sort of get lumped together because they're not as sexy. Like, oh, look, we discovered a new species of frog in, you know, Papua New Guinea or something. So there is that. But there is, amongst people who have this idea that something like Bigfoot exists, they kind of remind you, this is controversial and probably a crappy thing to say, but I'm going to say it, they kind of remind you of people who, almost like this like creationists using science to prove creationism.
That's what I don't understand, sense. Because it's like your whole point is that science is flawed, and because it's like an ever-changing concept, that you're probably living in a time period where the science that you believe is wrong and will eventually be proved as such. So that sort of in their mind negates the whole scientific process. But then they use that because we are in a society that so values that scientific recognition, they use those same concepts to sort of bolster their own theories, which seems like, if you're just going to go that way, go the way of, this is what I think, and I don't really care to bolster it with any kind of scientific evidence.
Exactly. It's that. I mean, it's I hate to bring it up regularly, but I contributed an essay to Robbie Graham's UFOs Reframing the Debate entitled "In for a Penny, In for a Pound," and it was the idea that once you, if you're going to be a ufologist who is looking at the abduction experience at all, you have to accept telepathy, because even in sightings where people see a craft, sometimes they'll get a telepathic message, mm-hmm. Or the craft will react to what they're thinking, and telepathy happens in, I would say, almost every single abduction. So you're already accepting something that shatters the existing scientific paradigm. Like mm-hmm. telepathy, some people will argue me on this. Don't at me, because I have quotes from scientific philosophers who argue otherwise, who are a lot smarter than me or you. So telepathy cannot exist in a physicalist or materialist paradigm, period, full stop. It means that we have to incorporate something else into that paradigm. So if you're already sullying your studies with something like telepathy, go all the hell in, because that's the direction the science is moving. It's moving towards a model like idealism, like maybe even animism, eventually, because there's great studies being done with psi research. There's great studies being done with consciousness research, and cryptozoologists are the last people to this party. You know, the near-death experiencer researches are already there. The ghost hunters are already there. The ufologists have finally gotten there, and cryptozoologists are still saying monkey in the woods. And it's you might as well just go all the way in and go into that non-materialist paradigm.
This is your final warning.
Oh, you're the guy that calls on the phone about my car's warranty.
Well, in this particular instance, it has nothing to do with your car's warranty. It has to do with Strange Familiar's Patreon. The price is going up. If you get in now at $3 a month, or if you want to do the yearly rate, that's fine too, or whatever level of support you go in at, I'm going to keep it. I believe I can do this. Or anybody who gets in now, I can just keep that level. I'll make it so new people can't sign up at that level. But I think I can keep it at that level. So as long as you keep paying at that level, you can get it for $3 a month. I think we're going to increase it to $4 a month sometime soon. I don't know if this is actually your final warning. But I do want to give people that heads up. So if you want to get in now, now's the time to do it. Now's the time to be a patron. You get extra shows, and it helps us. Helps us keep making Strange Familiar. So if you like what we do, it's a great thing to do. Patreon.com/strangefamiliars. You can check out all the different levels of support there. Again, I'm pretty sure if you pop in now at whatever level you want to go in at, if I raise the prices, you just stay paying that amount, and then you'll be able to maintain that level even if the price goes up for other people. Patreon.com/strangefamiliars. If you don't like the idea of a monthly subscription or yearly, there's yearly options at Patreon as well. If you just want to make a one-time payment via PayPal, go to the show notes under any episode at strangefamiliars.com. Look for the paypal.me link. You can click that, leave a one-time donation. Everyone can help by sharing the show on social media, by liking and subscribing wherever you're listening, whether that's some kind of podcatcher or YouTube, whatever service you use to listen to the podcast, and by leaving us those nice 5-star reviews, which does help get Strange Familiars in front of new potential listeners. And now let's get back to our conversation about Bigfoot and related matters.
I interpreted what you asked as, you know, at least the answer, if not the question, is, you know, why do they want to sit at the big kids' table, basically? And I really have to think that at this point, a lot of it is just so that they can say, "I told you so," to the scientific establishment. Like, I know that sounds absurd, and
they being the cryptozoologists.
And not even the cryptozoologists, but like, especially like the people who are like, not to offend a portion of our audience, but like the squatchers, the ones who are like really into like Bigfoot, Bigfoot's out there, you know, who just are like really Bigfoot obsessed. I think they just want to tell, you know, the scientific establishment, "I told you so," and I think it really does scratch that anti-authoritarian, anti-scientific establishment itch, which I totally get as somebody who's interested in the paranormal, but I think that might be a little bit where it comes from.
I mean, is it okay to love science and Bigfoot?
Sure.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, you've also got to love rational thought too, and intellectual honesty. Yeah,
the problem, and I've said this on umpteen different podcasts, and our goal I know was to kind of go into different places with this than we do in other podcasts. But the problem being that what we have is a bunch of really really good casts with dermal ridges and mid tarsal breaks. Like, they're really good and they're really convincing, and you have these experts like Dr. Jeff Meldrum who look at him and say, you'd have to be an expert like me to fake that cast. I can't believe anybody faked it. Alongside these, you have some ridiculous casts with, too many toes or too few toes or three toes or casts that look like something out of a 50s monster movie. But let's throw them aside and concentrate on the really good casts we have. So we have these really, really good casts on one hand, and that's it. That's really it. That's the best evidence we have. So if you take that, everything else we have, pretty much, yeah, a few hair samples and blood, but they're all controversial. They're all, none of them are accepted as authentic by the scientific community as a whole. So if you take that away, we have witness testimony. And the problem with witness testimony is that science hates it. Science hates witness testimony because people have, failed memories, and they bring other stuff to the table. They bring, their own interpretations, colored by whatever life experiences, they bring that to the table, and science hates it because you can't repeat that in a lab. And I love it because I'm a folklorist,
And Bigfoot isn't any different than Bigfoot or aliens or anything else that a huge swath of people have had some connection with, but where materialism and science fails, right? So what, these things still exist in some capacity, real in air quotes.
Yeah. I mean, and, if you think about psychology, Freud wasn't a big Jung fan, even though they started in very similar places. Freud was not a big Jung fan. And, where Jung eventually took things. So, when you get into these areas that can be interpreted, differently and colored by opinion and ideas and so forth, I think you get into like choppy waters that science, mainstream science, tends to get very uncomfortable with. That gravity's great. You can drop an apple, it'll fall every time. They like experiments like that.
Yeah, I mean, it comes down to something that, and once you start thinking about these phenomena and these terms, I think it really helps a lot. Something that Terence McKenna once said, and I wish I could find the lecture, but he said, science is great, but it doesn't understand the intricacies of a love affair or a military campaign. It doesn't have any mechanism or any tool to describe these very real things that happen in our lives. And, it's also this presupposition that there isn't anything that can choose to be in control of every situation. So phenomena that you can only study in the field are difficult enough, getting outside the laboratory. But once you posit the idea, there might be something that is in complete control of how it is observed and what data is collected, then you're just sort of left with, you're left with stuff like Bigfoot and stuff like synchronicities and stuff like UFOs, I think.
And in the sort of strict adherence to a dualism, it has to be one or the other. Like, this idea that something can be both things is just, it just makes people's heads explode.
Yes. Yes. And that's the most difficult. I mean, it's still, for me, it's very, very hard to wrestle with.
Because it either is or isn't, right?
Yeah.
Sometimes it is and isn't.
It is such a difficult concept. And for me to try to get people to understand, especially the Bigfoot fan that maybe was entirely convinced it was a gorilla of some sort that they could put in a cage one day, to get them to understand that no, I believe all these witnesses that talk to me. I believe them. Like, to my core, I believe them. And I believe what they saw was there when they saw it. But I also don't believe it's always there in the same way. And I do, but to, and then to go on to say, I don't know the mechanism by which it does these things, really makes people mad. Because they want you to say, it's not there sometimes because quantum physics, and this is how it does it. It has a box with these buttons on it, and it presses these buttons and throws that switch, and it goes into another dimension. I don't know. I don't know the mechanism by which it happens. but it certainly seems to be there sometimes and not there other times.
Yeah, if we can just sort of concede that these things happen and people experience them, and then work ourselves out of where we are historically, culturally, mm-hmm. it might be easier. Because I feel like we're, you know, we're in a society now where there's this constant battle between what people perceive as logical, scientific, rational. And that is, I'm not saying anything against it. I believe in being rational and scientific and having proof for things. But at the same time, it's a way to discount anything that doesn't fall into those parameters. And this way of viewing things is very new. Like, we're only maybe like 150 years into this concept of the scientific method. And everything that these people have experienced has predated that. And sure. with every generation, we experience the same phenomenon within our cultural context. So I feel like right now it's just the battle between how we're viewing things. It doesn't mean that these things don't exist. It's just that we have to get out of our heads on how to... It's like everyone's speaking a different language, and we just have to suss out how the common words that we have to speak.
Yeah, to communicate. I mean, I think you touched on several important things there. It's like... Some of it is Western society, right? And our relationship mm-hmm. to these things. We're not prepared for a spiritual idea of these things, but whatever your spirituality is, an ephemeral, apparitional idea of these things in any way. But if you talk to native cultures, they're like, yeah, of course. I mean, not all of them. This isn't universal. You can't monolithically speak of any native culture, much less all of them. But many, many, you know, native cultures are perfectly accepting of, like, yeah, it's here sometimes and it's not other times. What's the big deal with that? So in the West, we have this very materialistic view that, you know, maybe by necessity, and this fits into, you know, politics and the evolution of the West and everything else that this book isn't about. But, you know, maybe we had to go that direction in one way to do some of the things we did. Maybe we didn't, you know, I don't know. But it speaks to an earlier point, and this kind of calls back a little bit of an earlier point that Josh was talking about. Is there a place for ridicule in society? Maybe not in modern society, but in the evolution of society. Was there a place, did we have to at some point ridicule people? Because, you know, we do need people to understand that things like gravity exist, that gravity is real. And you can, if Johnny Nutjob comes out of the forest one day and starts preaching gravity doesn't exist, you know, it's your people are going to get hurt. You know, you can certainly prove to him that no, gravity exists. So maybe ridicule was a way to address that at some point in our society. However, it's not appropriate to ridicule, you know, everything, every concept that comes out. It's a fine line to walk. And I don't know if I'm making any sense at all.
Well, I think you are. I think that, I mean, this is the part of postmodernism that I think really gets it, you know, and I'm surprised that the postmodern community hasn't really latched on to the supernatural in a more profound way, because we really are talking about there being multiple versions of truth, and we really are talking about things that you believe literally manifesting as true or not true. And I think that there are some examples where that is a better or worse argument. But at the same time, I think that if we factor in things like the power of belief and the power of groupthink and the power of all these sort of different almost egregoric phenomena that happen around the way that societies choose to believe things, I think that's a very useful way to sort of pin a lot of this stuff down. You know, the duality thing, I think that you said it best in this volume, Tim. That's an example that I'm going to keep on using again and again, is the idea of the Möbius strip, how it sort of moves between two different worlds. But I think that you can even make it into a simpler analogy. I mean, we live every day with stuff that is walking that transitional borderline between non-physical and physical. I mean, I'm thinking... You know, before I started saying this, I had some points that I wanted to say, some things that I wanted to say. And those talking points were completely internalized until I actually chose to verbalize them. And now they're made flesh. And you see this in scripture, right? I mean, that's, you know, God speaking things into being. And I think that's where a lot of these phenomena are sort of pointing us, are in directions like that. And I know that sounds sort of esoteric and frou-frou for a lot of people who are still, you know, just now deciding to maybe abandon the wood ape hypothesis or the flesh and blood hypothesis. But man, that's a lot more interesting to me than a giant monkey.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing I found over time. It's more interesting and more rewarding. And you don't have to do the same kind of mental gymnastics that is required for there to be an 8-foot-tall giant ape man in the woods of Pennsylvania. And I'll just say Pennsylvania because that's where I live. You have to do some real mental acrobatics to make that work. I was out hiking with John yesterday, and we were hiking through Site 7. And I was looking around, and I said, what could I eat out here in the winter? Because John, you know, he does foraging and so forth. And he said, not much. He says, you're not going to survive off of plants in the winter. He's like, you're going to have to kill animals. And, you know, you start to, these realities start to sink in where you're like, wow, this is, you know, and all the points I made in the first volume of how many calories a creature that big would require, if it, assuming it has a big brain and the way it acts, it would have to have a big brain. And you look around at what's in the landscape and how it would have to be constantly eating and it's not cooking its food, so it's not getting the full calories out of it. It requires real mental acrobatics that, you know, while we didn't solve these problems at all, we certainly introduced different ways of viewing it where you don't have to, at least you don't have to do those same acrobatics. To me, that's much more fulfilling.
And you have to sort of circumvent science, ironically, to believe the modern day Bigfoot cryptozoologist view of it. You have to circumvent science to believe in their science.
Absolutely. Including the point of selective information, selective data. We've run across many cases of these people just taking selective data, and they'll take one part of the story, the part of the story that makes it sound like a big hairy ape, and they'll throw out the rest, the parts that are weird. My favorite example is Fluorescent Freddy, who was a big hairy creature that was seen in Indiana in the 1950s. And the kids there were calling it Fluorescent Freddy, and the newspapers picked it up. And I read about this in books written by, you know, famous quote-unquote cryptozoologists. Most of these guys, by the way, don't have a degree. They just call themselves cryptozoologists. And in this book, this person said, oh, he's called Fluorescent Freddy because of his glowing eyes. Well, if you read the report, yeah, he had glowing eyes. He had glowing red or orange eyes, depending on the report. But the reason the kids called him Fluorescent Freddy is because he was bright green. It was a green, hairy monster that kids were reporting. Now, that's a crazy detail, but it's a very important detail, and it's a detail that was left out of many, many reports in these cryptozoologist books. They want to talk about a hairy monster, but when they said it was green, that was just convenient. We'll just leave that part out. That sounds too kooky.
It sounds too much like Little Green Men.
Yeah, or something, again, from a 50s monster movie, which, ironically, this was seen in the 50s. But that's what, you know, that's what the people said. So if you're going to believe them when they say they saw a big hairy monster, and you're going to say, not believe them when they said it was green, I don't know what to do with that. It's really intellectually dishonest.
I do want to be clear, though, that, you know, there's a lot of conflation between the scientific method and science, you know, and scientism. These are all things that sort of get conflated, and materialism, they all sort of get conflated into the same soup. And I want to be very clear that I am pro-scientific method. You know, people will say that at the same time, science, you know, gave us modern medicine, and science gave us airplanes and whatnot. But I would say not really. You know, I think imagination gave us those things, and science made them be able to be formed into being. So, but I want to be clear that I'm very much pro-scientific method. It's just that some people have allowed other paradigms to taint the scientific method to the extent that they throw out outliers that they can't explain. But here's the thing, and I've talked about this before too, is, you know, these bigger conversations that we're embarking on. I know that, you know, Mike Clellan said at one point that if you're talking with someone about UFOs and you don't wind up talking about the meaning of life and God, you're probably having the conversation with the wrong person. And I really do think that there's something to be said for that. And I think that those sort of conversations are what cryptozoology could benefit from leaning into a little bit more. And I think that's the other thing, is that Where the Footprints End, Volumes 1 and 2 do not contain the answers to anything or the answers to life or what Bigfoot is or anything. But they're a step in opening up the dialogue in a different direction. You know, if someone wants to come along and write a book that talks about the exact same topics in a broader and more comprehensive way, A, I'm glad I'm not you, but B, please do it. Because, like, I think Tim and I would both rather just, like, see these things being discussed, please. Like, that's part of the effort of this is to destigmatize some of these otter outliers.
Yeah, yeah. I forget where I said it. I think in volume one where I said, like, people are going to come behind us. They're going to take our ideas. They're going to expand upon them, and I cannot wait.
I mean, yeah, that's the biggest compliment that I think any of us could get. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think my question was going to be something along the lines of, are they really altered states or just differing perceptions? Are we back to the same just sort of language that each individual person internalizes to explain things that happen to them? Or do you really think that these are these examples of altered states of consciousness are truly that?
Before Josh answers, I'll just say that with all of these chapters, we tended to paint with a pretty broad stroke. So we nested things under different chapters. So, you know, a lot of things we fit in different places that, you know, they're maybe not exactly going there, but they didn't have anywhere else to go. Like in the Stick Signs chapter, I talk about Bigfoot traveling on trains because it relates to hobos, and hobos had a whole sign system that they used. It's, you know, it's a tenuous connection, but where else do you put Bigfoot traveling on trains?
Yeah, unless you have a bunch of, you know, shorter chapters.
Right, right. So we tended to nest these different things, some of them appropriately and some of them tenuously. But I'll let Josh answer the question because it's his chapter.
Yeah, I mean, you know, my go-to example is there's not a chapter on bulletproof Bigfoot, even though that's a super common thing that you find in a lot of encounters. But there is a bulletproof Bigfoot section in the ghost chapter of volume one because ghosts are ephemeral. That seemed like a, you know, relatively sensible place to stick it. I kind of wanted to write the altered states chapter just because no one has really talked about that much in cryptozoology. There is a recurring theme that you'll find throughout a lot of indigenous testimony of these creatures being able to hypnotize people. A recurring theme of a buzz preceding encounters, which you'll find in a lot of different experiences, Marian apparitions, UFO abductions, and, you know, psychedelic trips, quite honestly, that I think are all sort of pointing to a possible shared mechanism. But when you get down to it, if this is the case, you would expect people to see Bigfoot-like entities when they take psychedelics. And there's a lot of strong evidence for, you know, type of alien archetypes that you see appearing in these altered states of consciousness. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of evidence for fairy type entities appearing, you know, when people smoke DMT or take psilocybin mushrooms, but there's not a lot of wild men that appear in altered states. So that is a little bit of a stumbling block. They do appear here and there. And you do curiously, even though I didn't put it in there, get a lot of people who sort of end up with like a 2001 Descent of Man sort of movie playing in front of them when they take certain psychedelics, or like they feel themselves devolving into like an ape man or something. I think that altered states of consciousness do play into, you know, one of those big issues that comes up that is one of those nested topics that Tim was talking about, the idea of mind speak or Bigfoot telepathy, because I think telepathy in some sense would be definitively an altered state of consciousness. What I found really interesting is, you know, that buzz in a lot of these other experiences, again, trips, BVM, apparitions, UFO abductions, seems like a symptom of the experience. And I wanted to see if it could be approached as the buzz being the instigator of the experience. And there is, again,
like in a lucid dream when there's something that recurring kind of snaps you into that reality of knowing that you are not in reality.
Yeah. Yeah. Kind of, or, you know, I mean, I still have a real soft spot for the idea that a lot of these encounters are with genuine intelligences, genuine others, but they are using endogenous dimethyltryptamine to facilitate communication or contact with us. dimethyltryptamine, for those who aren't aware, being a naturally produced psychedelic, recently proven, if memory serves, to come from the pineal gland, and long hypothesized to be an endogenous source of a lot of these experiences. So could these altered states be, instigated by some sort of exterior sound component?
Like some sort of like hypnagogic induction.
Hypnagogic, you know, you think about theta waves and the way that you can change your consciousness just by focusing on something. So, you know, there's a longstanding tradition of drones being used in meditative practice of, in certain Aboriginal groups in Australia, of using the didgeridoo, which I have right here. I do that every time.
So wait a minute. How much does playing tuba help you playing didgeridoo? Are they totally different things?
This has kind of got a big mouthpiece. I need to put some more wax around the hole so it tightens it up a little bit. So you're using a lot of air, but I did learn to circular breathe on tuba before I learned how to circular breathe for the didgeridoo. So there is a comparison to be made there, yeah. But yeah, put your lips together and blow, kid. So that idea of the drone occurs in a lot of transcendental practice, and that sort of corresponds roughly to the idea of a buzz. There are some Bigfoot witnesses who describe things that sound just like a didgeridoo. And that idea of a drone, a fundamental pitch with another pitch sounding over it, is found in overtone singing, which we found a passage in the Slate and Barry Bigfoot book that describes some sort of odd singing, like a chant, that Barry compared to hearing in a monastery in Japan. Overtone singing was practiced among some Ainu in Japan up until the last practitioner died in 1976. So we have the geographical component and the time frame both sort of line up with the possibility that Barry was making this, Barry who's passed away, you know, or otherwise we would have just asked him. Barry is drawing this comparison to the Bigfoot singing to overtone singing. And we have our lovely Timothy Renner, who captured something that sounds suspiciously like overtone singing, which sounds like this didgeridoo sound that people are mentioning in one of his on-site interviews at Pond Bank. So I think that there's something there, but I don't really... It's not enough to say that something else is making this sound, because people have heard these sounds coming from these creatures. So I don't know if there's a connection there, but I don't necessarily think that it's in that idea of, you know, this other ephemeral intelligence is making the sound and then people see Bigfoot. It seems like people see this Bigfoot, whatever it is, and then they hear the sound, and that's when some odd things happen.
Long way to come around to sort of answer your question, Allison.
Yeah, sort of answer your question. What was your original question?
That's why I thought, well, maybe it's better to just go with a lot of questions based on which way the wind was blowing with our conversations generally.
Did I answer your question, though? Can you repeat your question? Okay.
Yeah. I think because it's like, I just keep returning to this idea that it's a couple basic challenges. It's like we're in 2021. There's a huge battle between probably faith and science, or even just, and I think those words are probably inaccurate.
Someone said reality is having a midlife crisis.
Oh, I hear that. Yeah. and the thing is, like in Jung's case, instead of sitting down every night and drawing my demons and making them into mandalas and engaging with it, do some people at a time of crisis, or do they see Bigfoot? Is this just a limited engagement, short run, short release?
Limited edition. Signed and numbered.
Phenomenon, which if we were... more engaged, could we maybe find what the real issue is, or the real?
Well, I mean, I think that there's a Bigfoot inside all of our heads. I mean, it's kind of like I was talking to, shout out to Barbara and the Six Degrees of John Keel crew on an upcoming interview. I was talking with them about the fact that, like, you know, we all have memories of flying. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
like something about that feels like we've done it before, right? Like you, mm-hmm. when you have dreams and you fly, you're like, oh yeah, I've done this before.
Yeah.
And I kind of think that wild man going feral, wolf howling at the moon thing is kind of one of those things where it's like, yeah, I kind of something about that really speaks to me. Like, it feels like I did that in a past life or something.
Yeah, there's a great freedom to that thought of just being sort of primitive and ruled by these very scientific notions of like hormones and needs, and like you're ruled. There's a freedom in that you don't have to think anymore.
You move to instinct.
There's instinct and a world without like a certain amount of anxiety, because they talk about areas where people are, you know, just desperately trying to maintain living. There is not the rash of anxiety and depression that there is in places where we have time to think about that.
and unleashing the id too. I mean, mm-hmm. which isn't that what the werewolf shtick is? You know, yeah. the ego falls away and the id comes out to play.
The only thing I would caution in this line of thinking is the fact that this wild man has always been with us. Like, that I will stand by. So it's not a modern phenomenon. You know, it's not something that, I mean, we named it Bigfoot in the 1950s, but you know, by one name or another, it's always been there, you know, in the woods beside us, as I say.
Right. Yeah.
Our wild shadow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Totally.
Yeah. That's the perfect descriptor that puts a real pin in it, for sure.
I mean, he even really looks like what happens when you walk and look back and see physically your shadow. And while you know you're only a certain height, your senses are telling you that this shadow person is elongated or shorter or wider than you are. You're using your senses, but none of it is true. It isn't another person walking beside you. It isn't a bigger person or a smaller person.
Well, it also comes back to this idea that I played with when I talked about how, you know, the connection between jumping Frenchman syndrome, which has been talked about on the podcast, and Bigfoot. You know, I mean, with that, these lumberjacks were, you know, obviously the lumberjacks are, I couldn't find anything to say this, but they've got to be some sort of derivation of the wild man archetype or fulfilling some sort of role like that. Having, you know, this amazing strength and being compelled to mimic people, you know, voice mimicry and movement mimicry, this is all Bigfoot stuff, right? Mm-hmm. And it also ties into that idea, you know, you said the shadow, the idea that it's completely unscientific, but you see it happening time and time again, that human beings can become feralized. Like, you know, you mm-hmm. go off for 10 years in the forest and you come out like, you know, covered in fur with canines, you know?
Well, I mean, also, or you go 10 months without seeing other people's faces and smiles and the things that we recognize as signs of humanity, like the way people gesture, and all of that is gone for 10 months. And then you wonder why everyone hates each other.
that's true. Yeah. Yeah. Imagine that. What sort of a world would that be?
I kind of wish that the brother Richard was on here to be, because I'm a pretty bad advocate for the faith side of things, but I kept thinking about how, like, you know, Bigfoot is so much like God, and that, like, I absolutely believe genuinely 100% that someone like Brother Richard believes every part of his faith. But at the same time, it is also true for me that I have none of that, and I've never have. We experience the same things in life, but we see them through a different lens.
Yeah. I mean, I would say that you've evolved a sort of, I don't think acceptance is the right word, but definitely a compassion towards that line of thinking over time.
You've sort of Goldilocksed your way there a little bit. because you know, speaking with you is very different than speaking with someone who doesn't leave room for any of this stuff.
Right, yeah. Right.
Well, yeah, and I think that's part of the problem, because it's just as dual. It really is just as dualistic as someone who's, you know, anytime you take that extreme position and just don't allow for any kind of letting anything enter into your stream that doesn't fit with what you already think. I think that's the problem with most of the way in which our culture has seemed to stop evolving, is because we can't let anything else in because it doesn't fit our identity, doesn't fit our narrative. I mean, I think that's even why we're sort of backing off from certain ways of explaining Bigfoot, because we don't want to be lumped in with a certain identity of people who might think of it in a different conception and what that entire identity might mean.
Cognitive dissonance is a difficult pill to swallow. It's very, very, very large, and you have to swallow it continually if you want to try to be in any way honest, I think.
Yeah, just like that, being open to the idea that you might be wrong or that your idea might change as you learn more.
Yeah, and in a way, like, I think that's might be one of the frustrations. I mean, there's a type that's going to be frustrated with these books in general just because they exist. And as one person told me, you know, Bigfoot's a hairy, you know, undiscovered hominid, and anybody who thinks any different is crazy. Well, if you make statements like that, then, you know, where are you going to go? Like, anybody who experienced any weird stuff is either lying or crazy. That's what this person told me. Well, where can you go with that? Like, there's nowhere to go with that. It's not intellectually honest because it's not fair to the witnesses who have seen weird stuff. So you got those types, and then you have people who genuinely struggle with cognitive dissonance when they really, really struggle, and they will, like, okay, this weird stuff happens, but it's all explainable. You know, it's naturally explainable. The people were mistaken, or the Bigfoot, you know, didn't disappear. He jumped behind a tree and the person didn't notice it or whatever. You know, you have those types. And then you have people who, by nature, and I think that's the nature of this book, we're kind of saying, like, we don't know. We're taking all these things. We're just pointing you all the commonalities between the Bigfoot experience and these other experiences, the Bigfoot story and these other folklore stories. And we can show you all the very, very similar things and how similar they are. You know, 600 pages, again, between the two volumes. But at no point do we say, like, this is what it is, or Bigfoot's interdimensional, or any of that. And I think there's some frustration with that we do pick up on. And it's not always from the people, you know, that first type of person who says, you know, everyone's crazy or lying if they say anything weird happened. Sometimes it's from people who do mean well, but they're, you know, genuinely frustrated with us because our point of going into this. I mean, going into this, our point is we don't know and no one else knows either, but here are some ideas.
I think that's what people miss about these interviews that we do, Tim, is that, like, I'm frustrated by this, you know, and I love it when people come away and they say, these guys, you think the Bigfoot is interdimensional. Like, I have a huge problem with that. You know?
Right.
The idea that interdimensional is like this catch-all explanation for things, which is the way that it's often employed. You know, I'm frustrated by this data set too, but it doesn't, my frustrations don't make it go away.
Right.
And the people who want to adhere to this, you know, materialist undiscovered hominid line of thinking are doing just that. They're just sort of wishing this stuff away, and that's intellectually dishonest.
Right. And you have this sort of in between, which is, and again, I love Ron Moorhead, and he has done more in his life than I will ever do. Kudos to Ron Moorhead. He's been nothing but kind to me, so this is not trying to impugn his character in any way. But the idea that just saying, oh, it's quantum physics, and that explains it all, is just, you know, it's a different set of straws you're reaching for, in my mind.
It really is, to me, a sort of scientific way of saying how many angels can dance on the head of a pin. You know, it really is. It's like, you know.
And I love the quote that you attributed to me that was not me at all. At one point you said, yeah, remember when you said, like, if you think you understand quantum physics, you don't understand quantum physics? And
that was, yeah, it was Richard Feynman. It wasn't, yeah, it wasn't you at all. It was an actual quantum physicist.
Yeah, I was like, I really wish I said that. But but I mean, I think it applies. But I think that idea applies to the, it's like the halfway point. So these flesh and blood, you know, ape in the woods people can be like, all right, well, quantum physics is a real science, so it's still scientific, you know, and therefore weird stuff equals quantum physics, therefore perfectly normal, it's just an ape in the woods.
Yeah, I think that, and this completely flies in the face of what my next book is about, kind of trying to force everything into an understandable concept, but I think that at the end of the day, we really have to get comfortable with the idea that a lot of these concepts might be literally beyond our capacity to conceive of them right now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I remember Tim saying that he went through almost, I don't want to say a depression, but a real disappointment, and then sort of an acceptance, which I think helped blossom into this theory, was when he realized that he wasn't going to solve it.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Because he, like, there's this idea with, like, you know, Sasquatch hunting that you will be the one to magically figure out something that no one has yet to figure out. And like the thrill of that kind of a hunt is, why would you want to give that up and say, I will, there's no possibility of me ever figuring this out.
Right. Yeah. But, you know, 50 plus years, guys, we don't have one in a zoo yet. We got to start looking at it in a different way.
Well, same thing with the UFO question. I mean, you know, it's the Patrick Harper quote, you know, the fairies are always going, but never gone. And the, you know, the aliens are always coming, but never here. You know, well, disclosures this year, guys, yeah, you know,
right around the corner, Patrick Harper, my goodness.
That's who you dedicated the book to, right?
Yeah, yeah. Just, what I mean, what a mind on him. Sorry to stop things again.
No, I mean, it's, it's interesting because I actually have been seeing demonic reality crop up more and more on people's must-read lists,
yeah.
Actually.
Yeah.
Really warms my heart.
I don't know if we've played any part in that by talking it up so much, but if so, good. I don't think we've done any harm to it because, reading back through my disappearing evidence chapter, I just see place after place like, oh, I could have dropped a Harper quote there. I could have dropped a Harper quote there. He's just so eloquent in the way he phrases this stuff. It's, wow. I just, I can't say enough kind words about him.
It's one of the, you know, Demonic Reality is one of those books that whenever I go back to read it in preparation for another book, I'm like, why am I even writing another book? You know, it's like, it's pretty darn close, I think, to just being like the book, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. He's such a good writer too. It's not just the ideas, it's the writing. He can really write.
Yeah.
And back to Where the Footprints End.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. How about this?
There are some people who are going to adore this show and some people who are going to have turned it off already.
Just as last time, I think we, not to pat myself on the back, but I think we accidentally invented intersectional Bigfoot and pissed some people off.
Oh, people got so mad last time. Oh, that was the most controversial show we've ever done, and it shouldn't have been.
About intersectional Bigfoot?
Yeah,
just some of the ideas that were brought up in the last.
Yeah, the idea that there might be like a socioeconomic slant to the way people are dealing with what they see as Bigfoot, and how it kind of parallels a lot of racist thought about other cultures, and then we were talking about didn't we go into a little bit of feminist Bigfoot to the point where someone actually wrote and said she wanted to write a book with essays about like
Bigfoot from an intersectional perspective. People were very, very upset.
So it really was either like people who thinking like, oh my God, we really could frame all of this within these other constructs to people who were like, get off of my Bigfoot. The girl's talking about stuff.
And what's amazing to me is that like, I'm sure politically I probably identify with the you ruined Bigfoot crowd, but like, I find this so interesting. Like, I don't know. It's the great conundrum of how Tim and I are able to get along so well and everybody else in the Weird of the Road Goes Slack is at each other's throats.
Yeah, and we may be the furthest apart of anyone on there.
I know, right?
Yeah,
we're so far apart that we come back together.
Yeah,
that's the really beauty of shared phenomenon that's outside of the particular cultural narrative is that you can find your humanity in it. You can find something to have in common with other people. I think it's a incredibly hopeful place where we don't have to be divided by these just as ridiculous notions of politics.
Well, that's the thing that, you know, I've talked about this before, but, and I don't really know if this is in the Bhagavad Gita, but it was in a song that referenced the Bhagavad Gita, so I'm going to roll with it. Mm-hmm. It's the idea that the warrior and the pacifist, if they're both sincere in their goals, have the same goal in mind, you know? Mm-hmm. I think that there's a lot of that going on where people just want the best for everything. They just have vastly different ideas of how to accomplish it.
And I will say, honestly, the difference between, like, the music scene and the paranormal scene, give me the paranormal scene any day. People are kinder, people are nicer, people are way friendlier.
And more supportive and understand that they don't just, like, I think in the music community, people are so adjusted to this idea that they should not pay for the arts on any level. So any image you create, any song you make, is up for anybody to have at any time.
Mm-hmm.
And I think within the paranormal community, I think people are like, I really want you to keep doing this, so I'm going to help you. It just seems much more supportive.
It's very supportive. And, you know, it, again, people from different beliefs, you know, if it seems like I'm coming down on people, I'm really not. I really like respect all these different beliefs. I want my beliefs equally respected. That's all. But,
an excellent way to put it.
Yeah, but it's just a wonderful, wonderful experience it's been for me. And, you know, not to slag on the music community, but I'm just kind of comparing the two. Like, if I have to pick one, I'll take the paranormal community.
Well, I remember we talked about this on the way back when we tried, like, twice to record on the way back from that convention.
Oh, yeah.
And this was something that kept on coming up, was the fact that, like, you know, give me the people in the paranormal. The paranormal conferences are so much kinder than the people at in any given musical community, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I find it to be true. So, I love you listeners, and I'm not trying to offend anyone. Like I said, I let's just, you know, try to keep our minds open and look at these different things if we can. In the defense of the flesh and blood folks, I've had several come to me and say, look, I'm a flesh and blood guy, but I love hearing what you say, you know, and that's all I can ask for.
Yeah, and the other thing is I just would encourage everyone not to get their identity caught up in their pet explanation, because I do it myself. Mm-hmm. But to really realize that, yeah, if we all have the same goals, we're all earnest about it, we all want the same thing, which is the truth. It's just we all have to acknowledge where our own viewpoints fall short in explaining whatever's going on.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Where the Footprints End, Volume 2, High Strangeness and the Bigfoot Phenomenon. Volume 2 is Evidence, Volume 1 is Folklore. There's Evidence in Volume 1, there's Folklore in Volume 2, but we did divide them up. Like I said, you could start with either volume. You can find them both at Amazon. You can order them both from Josh or I, or you can order them into your local bookstore. You just probably have to ask them to order them. We're happy whatever way you get them. Josh, thanks for coming on Strange Familiars.
Such a pleasure. I love the fact that we were able to have such an interesting conversation, sort of skirting around the book. And I will also say that it has been a great journey with you, Tim, and I've learned a lot about myself throughout this process. A lot of things that, you know, about my own patience and some things that I'm good at and some shortcomings of my own. But I really think that there's a special bond here between the two of us. And I think that this is a good commemoration of that.
Absolutely.
And going into the future, I actually think that our next independent projects are going to complement each other quite well. So that'll be interesting to see if we keep on writing companion books to each other for the rest of our careers.
Absolutely. Josh, where can people find Josh?
Joshua Cutchin, JOSHUACUTCHIN .com. My email is foodtaboo@gmail.com, but you can link to the contact form there. Links to all my books, all my interviews, and yeah, you can get all those directly from me. I have all of them in stock, so.
Awesome. And if you're a patron, we're going to continue this discussion, talk about some disappearing evidence for patrons. Allison, thank you for hosting our discussion tonight.
Sorry it wasn't a real interview, but I can't.
No, it's hey, we've done plenty. The idea with Strange Familiars is let's kind of talk a little bit more freely and hopefully get into stuff that we don't get into on other podcasts.
Yeah. Well, thanks for having me.
It was awesome.
Okay, I just want to mention one more time, I know we said it at the end there, but our patron show for February is going to be a continuation of this conversation, but it's a little bit more focused. We talk about the chapter on disappearing evidence, which is one of my favorite chapters that I wrote in Volume 2.
And I believe this is the, you couldn't see me because we were in different rooms when we were recording, and the entire time I had my snarky eyebrow up, so just imagine that as you listen. Mm.
Well, because I think your idea was you're looking for definitive evidence, and I'm just talking about the phenomenon of disappearing evidence.
Yes, yeah. Yes. And later on, I thought, well, that was sort of a disservice because you weren't claiming that as evidence. You were claiming it more as like the phenomenon itself of potential evidence, which is yet to be decided how relevant disappearing, whether it's relevant or not.
Yeah, exactly. It's, like I said, my favorite example is the Patty film, where you have both the film, which is the potential evidence of something real, potentially, and the suit, which is potential evidence of it being a hoax. And both are missing.
Both are missing.
You can't find either one. I mean,
and the one definitive, well, the one definitively existed.
One way or another.
Yeah.
Yes, it had to. Like I said, that film either shows a man in a suit or a creature.
Yeah.
Like, there's no in between. That's one of those two things. If you want to hear that, you got to be a patron. Patreon.com/strangefamiliars. We should be dropping that in the next couple of days, I think, for our patrons. And I want to thank our patrons. Thank you all so much. It is a huge help to us, and we absolutely couldn't do Strange Familiars without you. You guys make the shows happen, so thank you. I also want to thank Samantha N. for her PayPal donation. Thank you very much. That also helps a great deal. It's awesome. So thanks so much. For our photo of the week tonight, we have a ferrotype, which is the same thing as a tintype. I'm being fancy. You tell me about this picture.
Well, it's kind of unusual sometimes to see very obviously blonde children in photographs, especially early on. Sometimes those yellow tones would darken in the process. So this is a little girl who very much has very, very light hair. And then she's standing in front of a painted backdrop that's actually much more realistic than a lot of other ones.
Yeah, it's a really nice painting. Yeah.
And her hand is on an empty chair, which sometimes that represents a loss in the family. And sometimes it's just the photographer's chair.
Sometimes it's just to steady a kid, right?
Yeah, just to have a place to stand, yeah.
I say there's a ghost in that chair.
Yeah, it's her identical twin sister is sitting in that chair. You just have to know.
That's a spooky story.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
But it's a little spooky in its own just to see someone with just such a shock of blonde, almost white hair.
Yeah.
In a tintype. Okay, listen to that sound.
We're not doing an ASMR podcast.
But if we were, this is...
So if...
It makes a great sound. See, I have neither the nails or the 25-year-old body to be an ASMR artist, so I'm just going to have to do it.
Ooh, I like the sort of, I like that sound. All right. So if you want to see this photo, you can go to the show notes under this episode at strangefamiliars.com. There will be an image of that. You can click on it. It'll take you to our Etsy page, where you can buy that or other photos of the week. We still have some left. Guess how many photos of the week we've done?
I don't have a good sense of that. 30?
Way more.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. I have no
idea.
We're
over 60 now.
Seriously?
We're in the 60s, yeah.
I had no clue.
Yeah. Some of those are still available.
Go ahead and check it out. Could be because the past year is somewhat of a blur.
It is, yeah. Our Etsy shop name is Lost Grave. That's one word if you type it in. But if you type in Strange Familiars, our stuff should come up. You can find it that way. While you're at Etsy, I just added a bunch of new artwork, new to the Etsy shop. Mm-hmm. It's older stuff that I had done. I did a book and CD called Undeath. I want to say in 2010 or around that time. But it was a little art book and a CD that came together. Actually, it was kind of a thick art book and CD that came together. I did a bunch of artwork. I had stopped drawing for a long time, and to get back into drawing, I was doing this whole series of these ghosts, essentially, these spirits, these weird things. And I did this whole album based around it. So I have a ton of these drawings just laying around from that series where I was sort of getting back into drawing, finding my drawing legs again, in a sense. I put the last of those up, I think. I want to say it's the last. I might find another stack of them someday.
It's very likely.
But some of them are real inexpensive. If you want an original piece of my artwork, like some of them are $25.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Get a half page. Is it there like 8.5 by 5.5 or roughly? There's other artwork there as well. I just sold both frontispieces to Where the Footprints End 1 and 2. I don't know if the person wants their name announced, but thank you for buying this. Wonderful. The cover for volume 2 has gone to the same person that bought the cover to volume 1.
So I like when things find the right home.
Yeah. I want to thank Maynard for that. So keep your eye out though on Etsy. I'll be dropping more artwork there as either I find originals or as I do more and so forth. You can also get our books there. You can get Where the Footprints End, Volume 1, Volume 2. I just put up a set if you want to order them both together. You can buy them both. You get a little discount when you order them both together. All my other books are up there, including my art book, Apparitions, Illustrations of the Other. still trying to get that on Amazon. They're not opening up their warehouses to new titles at this point. So
we've quarantined them in a box for quite a while. I think they'd be safe to ship.
Well, waiting to hear back from them. But until they take Apparitions, it looks like we're the only place to get it. Well, us, Riverbend Comics, and there might be a couple other mail order places that bought them from me directly. Or you can get them in American Daydream Antiques in York, if you're local. Always have copies of my books there as well. Thanks for listening, everybody. If you want to continue the Bigfoot strangeness, you can check out our Patreon episode. There'll be a follow-up part two to this conversation. Otherwise, we will be back next week with another episode of Strange Familiars. Strange Familiars is a production of Dark Hollow Arts. Music, books, art, podcasts, and more. Intro and background music is by Stone Breath. Go to stonebreath.bandcamp.com for more. We are on Facebook, facebook.com/strangefamiliars, where you can join the Strange Familiars gathering group. And we are on Instagram @strangefamiliars.
Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.